You're listening to a WOSU Public Media podcast. Everything you hear is funded by listeners like you. Become a member of WOSU Public Media today and support digital content like Snollygoster and the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast. Make a gift at WOSU.org.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We haven't had a U.S. Supreme Court like this for more than 25 years. That is a majority conservative court nominated by Republican presidents opposed to abortion rights. In 1992, the conservative majority surprised many, however, when they reaffirmed what they call the, quote, essential holding of Roe in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Now, with the prospect of a new conservative majority court, Republican-led state legislatures from Arkansas to Ohio are passing ever more restrictive abortion laws in a bid to establish the next test case. Washington Post journalist Robert Barnes has been covering the Supreme Court since 2006. Welcome back, Robert.
Thanks for having me.
For some historical context, looking back to 1992, Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, David Souter were nominated by Republican presidents. They had the necessary five votes to overturn Roe, but they didn't. How did they explain their votes back then?
Yeah, you're right. It's a little bit of deja vu to now when so many are expecting this Republican majority on the court to overturn Roe. That was a case that was basically designed to put the issue before the court and to decide what to do about Roe. Even the pro-abortion rights side wanted a decision on Roe, in fact, so it could be used in the presidential elections in case it went against them. But those three decided to find a middle ground. And what they said was they weren't going to overturn Roe. They thought that that would be bad for the Supreme Court's image to overturn it at the time. And instead, they reaffirmed the basic right found in Roe. But they said that the new test is that the right of a woman to choose an abortion before viability and to obtain it without undue interference from the state is reestablished. And that has been come to be called the undue burden test. And it says that before a fetus is viable outside the womb, the state can't raise an undue burden. As you can imagine, courts have been trying ever since then to figure out what exactly is an undue burden.
Can I ask you if you know if in Ohio and across the country, it's been sort of death by a thousand cuts kind of when it comes to abortion rights. But so any restriction in and of itself is not ruled an undue burden per se. But the aggregate of them, has that been tested?
Well, that could be. I mean, what even in the Planned Parenthood v. Casey, that 1992 case, the court upheld three of the four restrictions that Pennsylvania had put in place, but it wouldn't go further than that. And so things like a 24-hour waiting period, a 48-hour waiting period, the need for an ultrasound before an abortion, the requirement that doctors tell women certain things about abortion. All of those have been upheld by courts, but more drastic measures like the week limits that are in some of these bills now, you know, that no abortion after a certain number of weeks, those are the kinds of things that have been turned down because they impose an actual ban on the procedure not just some restrictions around it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Robert Barnes. He's a Washington Post reporter. He covers the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're talking about the state strategies to get the issue of abortion rights once again before the U.S. Supreme Court, now that it is now, again, a solid conservative majority established or not with court justices nominated by presidents who oppose abortion rights. When they were questioning the last two nominees to the court, the issue of established law or came up several times in lots of different ways, and how they felt about established law. I mean, I might be
so-called super precedent.
Yes,
that they ask about, right?
And did that have to do with abortion? I'm wondering, or was that kind of what it was all about?
It always has to do with abortion. Okay. I mean, that's what these. That's what these nominations in many ways have turned into. And what was very interesting about the new justice, Justice Amy Coney Barrett, if she replaced Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who had a background before she got on the court as extremely supportive of abortion rights as being necessary to sort of the equal standing of women in American life. She was replaced by someone who had been just as outspoken against Roe v. Wade. Amy Coney Barrett, as a law professor, had several times talked about Roe being wrongly decided. She has mentioned her strong Catholic faith and that she opposes abortion. And when she was confirmed, Senator Lindsey Graham, said for the first time, we have a woman justice who is unashamedly pro-life. Now, of course, Barrett said that her personal opinions wouldn't affect the way she votes as a justice and the way she interprets the law. But we had, a huge swing on the court when she replaced Justice Ginsburg. And I think that that's what gives anti-abortion politicians so much hope for trying to get the issue before this Supreme Court.
The undue burden standard, I'm still back on the issue of how much burden accumulates and whether or not they take that on, or it's always by nature of how decisions are made, it has to be on a case-by-case basis.
Right. And there's not a terribly good standard on that, partly because the court keeps changing. The individual justices have their own views about it, ranging from Justice Clarence Thomas, who is quite clear he would overturn Roe at the first opportunity and send this issue back to the states to have them do whatever they want to on the issue. Right now, the sort of person in the middle of the court is Chief Justice John Roberts, or at least that's the way it appears. We don't have a ruling really from Justice Barrett yet that would tell us more about how she would approach the issue. And the Chief Justice never supported never found an abortion restriction too restrictive until last term. And that was when a Louisiana case was before the court. It was almost identical, the law to a Texas law that the court had struck down several years earlier. He went along with the liberals in that case to say that this law had to be struck down too because of the court's reliance on precedent. But he didn't agree with the reasoning of the case. And he says, you don't really balance whether or not the reason for the restriction is good enough to be upheld, that that's not something for courts to do, that's for legislatures to do, but that you look back to this Casey ruling and whether it presents an undue burden. And again, that gets into an undue burden on who? Does it mean a certain percentage of women? Does it mean a certain percentage of women who would be seeking an abortion? Those kind of questions have not been sorted out yet completely by the court.
Even after all these years. And you mentioned that the 1992 court at the time concerned about its reputation, concerned about its legacy. What about this court now? Any sense that that's going to have be an issue?
Well, I think that that's certainly, I mean, we can only go by what the justices write. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't see into their hearts. I certainly think that the Chief Justice is extremely concerned about the court's reputation. He would like the court to stay out of political matters when it can. He's certainly made that clear. You know, he also has shown that he, as I say, upholds abortion restrictions. I think that would the court like to see a big headline that says the Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade? I'm not so sure the court would like to see that. But it's also, as we've discussed, not necessary for the court to do that in order to uphold a number of restrictions on abortion that the court, that the states are coming up with.
There are so many. I mean, there have been for the last several years, many laws passed or proposed. How do they decide what to take up?
Well, it takes four justices to take up a case, and five, of course, to form a majority. And so often the court might have those four justices, but they don't want to take the case if there's not going to be a fifth justice to do it. The court has been considering since September a case from Mississippi. Mississippi is one of the states that basically keeps passing restrictions in hopes that the Supreme Court will take up one of them. Right now, the court is considering a law that would ban abortion after 15 weeks. Mississippi has also passed one that would ban abortion after 6 weeks. Both of those have been struck down by the lower courts, who said, that this simply is unconstitutional based on Roe and Planned Parenthood, and that states can't do it. And so now it's at the Supreme Court. They're asking, the Supreme Court basically to overturn those and approve this law. And the court has been considering it since September with no decision about whether to take it on for the next term. Normally, that means that they're not going to take the case, and one of the justices is writing a dissent, one or more, from that decision and saying why they need to take up the issue. But you can't always say that that's what's happening. Sometimes they'll hold a case for months and months and months and then finally grant it. And so that Mississippi case is going to be our sort of first clue about what this new court wants to do on abortion.
I wondered if the delay had to do with the nomination and confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett in the meantime.
Well, the court does like after a new justice joins, they don't sort of want to throw them right into something huge.
Right.
And so often the court will try to avoid some extremely controversial issues for a while. Anything that they did at this point would not be considered until next term anyway. But I think that that certainly it figures into the court's decision. And also, as you say, there are going to be a lot more opportunities. This Mississippi case is certainly not the only chance the court is going to have to take up an issue like this.
At this point, I'm just asking you to guess now, but I'm wondering if they decline to take the Mississippi case up at this point, can they do it for whatever reason they want? Can they just decline it, or do they have to have
They don't have to give a reason at all.
Okay.
And usually the court doesn't give a reason when it doesn't take a case. They right. just deny it without comment. And that often happens. Sometimes a justice will write, as I say, a dissent from that decision okay. saying, you know, we should have taken this case and here are the reasons why. Justice Thomas does that quite a bit with abortion cases and with gun control cases when the court doesn't take them up. And so, you know, maybe we learn a little something. But as I say, they also know that there are going to be a lot more cases like this. This is not the only opportunity. And then, now, you know, one thing that could change here, this uh-huh. is, as I say, usually these cases are all turned down by lower courts who yeah. say, you know, sorry, even though we may agree with you, we can't do anything because of the Supreme Court precedent here. And this clearly violates the Supreme Court's precedent. Now, what if an appeals court says, well, you know what, we think that this is constitutional and it's time for the court to look at this again. And so we're going to say, yes, it can go into effect. Then you would have a change dynamic and you would have the liberal justices wanting to take up the case. Right now, the liberal justices are happy to not have this issue come before the court.
We are going to continue our conversation. My guest is Robert Barnes. He is a Washington Post reporter. He covers the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're talking about, of course, the strategies by the states to put the issue of Roe v. Wade, abortion rights, before the U.S. Supreme Court again. They want conservatives want the Roe v. Wade decision to be overturned in some fashion. And they now have the majority back in the court to maybe achieve that. Coming up, we'll have others join us from Arkansas and from Ohio. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The race is on to get a case before the U.S. Supreme Court that would challenge Roe v. Wade, the abortion rights ruling from 1973, when Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson signed one of the most restrictive abortion measures into law in early March. He said the goal was to bring the fight to the U.S. Supreme Court. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine in 2019 made similar remarks about Ohio's so-called heartbeat bill, which became law earlier that year.
If that bill is going to be upheld, it will only be upheld in the United States Supreme Court. We knew that when it was passed. We knew it when I signed it. We should let that play out. We should go see what the United States Supreme Court does in regard to either that case or a similar case.
Still with us, Washington Post Supreme Court correspondent Robert Barnes. He has covered the court since 2006. Joining us, Karen Kassler. She's bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Welcome back, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Sarah Kellogg is the politics and government reporter at KUAR, the NPR affiliate in Little Rock, Arkansas, where she covers the legislature. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Sarah, give us a thumbnail of what the Arkansas law would do.
Yeah, so the bill completely bans the practice of abortion at any stage. It does list some medical exceptions for where abortion would be allowed, and those are to save the life or the health of the unborn child, to remove a dead child caused by a, quote, spontaneous abortion, and to remove an ectopic pregnancy. What the bill doesn't include are exemptions for instances of rape or incest, which did cause some members who have voted for anti-abortion legislation in the past to express concern or not even vote for the bill.
What about penalties?
Yeah, so there are penalties. And it's really, the penalties are going towards the people providing the abortion okay. more than the person seeking it. And so punishments for performing an abortion under this legislation could include a fine of up to $100,000, jail time for up to 10 years, or a combination of fines and jail time.
Now, Governor Hutchinson signed the bill. He said he wanted exemptions that he said would help it get its chances of getting to the Supreme Court. What were the exemptions? It was the rape and incest exceptions?
Yeah. Okay. And so when he was asked, while the bill was still going through the legislature, he was asked whether or not he was going to sign it. And he said that, you know, he had a history of signing every anti-abortion bill that came to his desk, but this one did give him some pause. And it was because of a lack of exemptions between for instances of rape or incest. And even as he signed the bill, he still expressed those concerns and said that's something that he particularly wanted. And he also thought that it would increase the chances of a review by the Supreme Court if those exceptions were in the bill.
So, Robert Burns, what about that? Why does that increase the chances of a day in court?
Right. I'm not sure that it does. It's what folks say sometimes. And we're all sort of speculating as to what's going to be the case that would grab the court's attention and get them to do this. It would seem to me that one that is more, limited would be something that the court would want to take up first, rather. But as you say, they want a bill. I mean, the states want to pass bills that clearly call Roe and Casey into question and would require the court to say whether or not those are still good law. And so that's why, in many cases, these laws do seem extreme.
Sarah, the law doesn't go into effect until summer, unless it's challenged and stayed before then. Or I guess it can't be until it's supposed to go into effect. I'm not sure, but it's interesting. Laws don't go into effect until 30 days, or is it 90 days after the legislature recesses?
Yes, it's 90 days after, unless they sign an emergency clause, which obviously would have it as soon as the governor signs it. But in this case, it did not have an emergency clause. And so it will be 90 days after the session adjourns. There's no set date for that. Last session, they do a general session every other year. So 2 years ago, they adjourned around April and with an official adjournment in late April. So it might be around the same time. So we're looking at definitely at the earliest a summer implementation, but there are already... the ACLU of Arkansas has already indicated it's going to challenge that bill in court.
Right. And what are the expectations it will survive a challenge?
Well, with the judge, U.S. the District Judge Christine Baker, she has a history of striking down these abortion laws. So for that first challenge, it will most likely be struck down. But that's what, ultimately that's what the sponsors of this bill want. They want it to be struck down because they want to make it to the Supreme Court. So likely it will be struck down either before it takes law or while right before it takes law. And so that's likely the situation.
Robert Burns, do the litmus tests of the past apply today? And can you predict at this point which ones might make it?
It's hard to do that. I think that it's not hard to predict that these laws will be struck down by lower courts. They have to abide by the Supreme Court precedent. And, the record is sort of filled with lower court judges saying, I have no choice but to strike down this law. I think that the Supreme Court should re-examine Roe or Casey, but there's nothing that I can do at this point until the Supreme Court acts. I mean, what the court has taken up in the past are laws that, that restrict abortion in some ways or restrict abortion clinics or would cut down on, impose regulations on abortion clinics that are hard to meet. That's what the last two cases were about, one from Texas and one from Louisiana, that basically would have, it didn't regulate the procedure, it regulated the clinics and the people who perform the abortions. And so both of those were struck down by the Supreme Court, narrowly. And those have been the kind of cases that the court has been taking up. It sent back not too long ago a case from Indiana that said that a woman couldn't choose an abortion if it was because she had learned the race, the sex, or some sort of abnormality with the fetus, basically Down syndrome. And the court
Oops, we lost you, Robert. Okay, well, we're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We just lost Robert Barnes of The Washington Post. We'll see if we can't get him back. In the meantime, Karen Kessler, an Ohio State study released in February found that 1 in 10 women surveyed believe that abortion already is illegal in Ohio. It is not. NARO Pro-Choice Ohio Executive Director Kayla Copeland put out this statement about that study. It's important that people who are making the decision to have an abortion now aren't discouraged from doing so because of a ban that could theoretically go into effect much later. Responsible discussion of abortion access by legislators, lobbyists, activists, or the media must make it clear that the Ohio abortion providers are open for patients who need them. I used a phrase earlier. It was death by a thousand cuts. I mean, at some point, is it impractical to think about getting an abortion in Ohio now because of all the regulations?
Well, I think that's been part of the goal of some of these activists to try to do these TARP laws, these that are a trap, I think. It's trying to nibble around the edges of legislation since abortion is still it is legal in all 50 states, but 43 of them do have some sort of limitations, and some of them are pretty restrictive. I mean, in Ohio, we have a ban on abortion after 20 weeks, except for the threat on the life of the woman. And also, Ohio did pass a six-week so-called heartbeat bill abortion ban. That's, of course, tied up in the courts. But then there are these other pieces of legislation. I mean, Robert was just talking about the Down syndrome ban, which a lot of other states have passed. There's even a ban that was passed last session on prescribing abortion drugs through telemedicine. And so all of these things are considered part of the overall effort to try to restrict abortion rights to make it so that abortion is so difficult to access in Ohio and in other states that it is essentially illegal. That's been the tactic of people who want to restrict abortion rights. It's pretty clear. And in Ohio, they have a legislature and a governor who are very friendly to this. I mean, Mike DeWine may be the most pro-life governor ever in Ohio, and that's saying something when you consider former Governor John Kasich and other folks.
He signed into law something like 25 restrictions.
Yeah. And so and DeWine has always been, that's been one of his primary issues. And so I think, you know, certainly we've got a supermajority of Republicans in the House and Senate, and there's been an effort to try to pass at least one abortion related bill virtually every session. And there are multiple ones quite often.
Is it the same thing in Arkansas, Sarah Kellogg?
Well, it's funny to hear Karen say a lot of these bills because Arkansas has definitely passed a lot of the bills that she mentioned. And earlier they were talking about the bill that would not allow abortions if there was a Down syndrome diagnosis. That Arkansas has passed that. That's being held up in the court. That was passed 2 years ago. Another bill passed 2 years ago was an abortion trigger law that if Roe v. Wade were to be overturned, it would ban the practice of abortion in Arkansas. And it's funny, you know, looking at that bill, the trigger bill versus the ban that was just signed into law earlier in March, that's actually pretty much the exact same wording. It's the same bill more or less, except for this one doesn't have a trigger warning. You know, it doesn't have, it goes into effect now versus waiting for the Roe v. Wade to be overturned. And another, I'm trying to think of other, I mean, it just definitely Governor Hutchison has a history of signing anti-abortion legislation. There was a news conference earlier in the session that said that Arkansas was the most pro-life state in the United States with the amount of pro-life legislation that was being signed into law. I'm trying to think of other bills, and another 2019 bill would have made sure that talking about the restriction of the clinics themselves versus the practice, this bill would have required doctors who performed abortions to be board certified or board eligible in obstetrics and gynecology. And that bill would have closed the only clinic in the state that provides surgical abortions, because there are only two clinics in Arkansas that provide abortions and one is more medical abortions. And so definitely there's a history here, and there's, you know, several bills going through the session right now in addition to the ban.
Hey, Robert Barnes, before we have to let you go, I wanted to ask you about the Arizona bill that was proposed. It's House Bill 2650 in Arizona, and it actually calls for Roe v. Wade to be ignored in not so many words. I mean, what's the what kind of impact might something like that have?
Yeah, well, that would seem to be tough to get the court to do that. But, you know, they're trying different things and to see what will work. There are also a number of states that are passing constitutional amendments in their own constitutions that would say, in case Roe v. Wade is overturned, there is nothing in our state constitution that would that a woman could use to say that she has a right to abortion under the state constitution. And so there are so many of these measures out there that basically are just waiting for the Supreme Court to do something. And, you know, when that happens, no one knows. It's been a waiting game for decades now, right, to see if the court is ever going to do something about the decision in Roe and the follow-up decision in Casey. And there certainly is reason for states that want to do something to be optimistic with the composition of the court right now.
That same Arizona law would allow those who receive abortions and the doctors who administer the abortions to be prosecuted for homicide, including first-degree murder. And in Arizona, that first degree is punishable by the death penalty. Some people, that's an incitement to violence or suggest violence. Does anything like that move the courts traditionally?
Well, I think that would just be one of those cases where the lower courts would strike it down. I couldn't see it going too far. But, you know, as I say, there are a lot of ideas out there that states are trying. And, you know, it all depends on what the Supreme Court is going to do. And so far, I mean, there would be no indication that a bill like that would get very far, even if it's passed.
Would the court take up several states' laws at the same time?
You know, I don't know. I think that is unlikely.
Okay.
You know, and I should tell you here, you know, a lot of these questions, I'm afraid I have to answer with sort of what I like to call educated speculation.
Of course,
It's hard to really know. But I would think that, you know, the court's pattern has been to take up a specific law from a specific state, which might be representative of a lot of other laws that are out there. Because as we've been talking about, a lot of these laws are you know, all come from the same sort of genesis, this sort of the anti-abortion movement that wants to have these same kind of restrictions in each state. And so I think it's more likely the court would take up one case, but it would probably be representative of a lot of laws if it were to do that.
Robert Barnes, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Robert Barnes is a reporter for The Washington Post. He covers the U.S. Supreme Court. We will continue our conversation. We're talking about the strategies to get the issue of abortion rights before the U.S. Supreme Court again. And we're going to be talking about the impact going forward on, you know, what a couple states are experiencing given the proliferation of legislation to restrict or outright ban abortion at certain stages. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Although an Ohio State study released in February found that 1 in 10 women surveyed believed that abortion is illegal in Ohio, it is not. The confusion might stem from the annual flurry of bills introduced, and many of which are enacted in Ohio and elsewhere, attempting to restrict or ban abortions and force a test case before this U.S. Supreme Court. Ohio's so-called heartbeat bill, which bans abortions after 6 weeks of gestation, was signed into law in April 2019, but it has never gone into effect. Still with us, Sarah Kellogg. She's the politics and government reporter at KUAR, the NPR member station in Little Rock, Arkansas, where she covers the legislature. Karen Kassler is the bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. I kind of wanted to, as we just mentioned, the flurry of bills, the annual flurry of bills now that goes before the Ohio General Assembly, and as you mentioned, Sarah Kellogg, as well in Arkansas, it's confusing people now. It's having a concrete impact on people's perceptions of what is legal and what is not. And I'm wondering, Sarah, if you could just give me a sense about how accessible abortion is now in Arkansas. How many hoops do you have to jump through, and are there how many clinics are there?
Yeah, so with abortion in Arkansas, I would be curious to see if there was a similar survey done for those in Arkansas to see that practice, because there are a couple hoops. Now, a couple of the bills that were passed 2 years ago, again, which is the one that would have required doctors who perform abortions to be board certified or board eligible, and obstetrics, is held up in court. Another abortion ban at 18 weeks, and later that has been held up in court. So there have been bills that had passed, but ultimately, a lot of them aren't enacted because of court challenges. Uh-huh. But right now, there are two abortion clinics in the state of Arkansas, and both, the only surgical one is in Little Rock, so the center of the state. So that's a 4-hour drive from Fayetteville. It's definitely a distance, and time is definitely an obstacle for those seeking an abortion in Arkansas, and the other clinic would allow for medical abortions. So it's definitely, there could be more clinics, there could be ways to make it more accessible. But as far as hoops, I'm still kind of a newbie here in Little Rock, and so I don't know the extent of the laws, but those are the ones I can think of at the top of my head.
And is there any evidence that all of these restrictions have affected the number of abortions being administered in Arkansas in any real way?
Yeah, that I do not know. Okay. I know that there is one bill that's actually been law right now, which would require Arkansans seeking an abortion to call a hotline that would give them all the alternatives beside, all the resources they can get beside getting an abortion. So there's definitely bills that are going to that would not quite ban the practice, but it definitely would be another obstacle in the way. And I'm sure that does reduce the amount of abortions if someone learns the resources. Or another bill that has been passed yet, which is called the Right to Know and See Act, and that's still going through the legislature, would require those seeking abortion to have an ultrasound, providers to provide an ultrasound before they were to get an abortion. So I would say that there are obstacles in the way that prolong the practice, but I'm not sure about, those are discouraging to get it.
What about the pro-abortion rights lobby in Arkansas? What do you make of that at this point?
Well, there are several organizations. There is the Arkansas Family Council, which is one that is very pro-life, anti-abortion. There's another. Or did you say pro-abortion?
Pro-abortion
or
abortion rights. Yes.
Sorry. Yes. Sorry.
Wrong
way.
Like an
different
one.
Yeah. So that would be the ACLU of Arkansas is definitely the largest one in that. And right after the governor signed that law, they released a statement and saying that Arkansas politicians have made it their business to dictate people's personal medical decisions and to block them from care. They called the abortion ban cruel and unconstitutional. And they did say that Governor Hutchinson, we will see you in court. And so they plan that is, I would say, the ACLU is the organization that most goes for that, but obviously okay. Like Planned Parenthood Arkansas, they're a presence, but ultimately they don't stop these bills. It's not enough to stop the supermajority in both legislatures to pass these bills.
Right. Karen Kassler, what about in Ohio? I mean, is there any sense about, does anybody study what the actual impact has been on access to abortion in Ohio after, these many years now since the Pennsylvania ruling? It's just been one after another, starting with, how clinics had, what kind of information they had to provide and when they had to provide it. And it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah, that's actually one of the elements of the fetal remains ban that is in place, or the bill that deals with fetal remains requiring abortion providers to either cremate them or bury them. That's one of the elements of that, that abortion providers are saying, we don't have any details and any rules, any guidance, any paperwork on how we're supposed to comply with this law. And they went to court saying, we can't comply with this law by the time it takes effect next month. So what are we supposed to do? We need to stay on the law. And they actually were rejected on that. So I think that's kind of an interesting element here, that abortion providers have said that they don't have what they need to comply with the law. And then, of course, you'll remember several years ago when there was an abortion measure that was put in the state budget that required transfer agreements for abortion clinics to maintain with hospitals. And then there were hospitals, or there were clinics who said, we don't have the ability to do that. There's nobody in our area that will accept the transfer agreement with us. And so that created a lot of problems for the clinics. And it also resulted in, of course, legal action. Right now, we have 9 clinics in Ohio. 3 of them are medication only. And it's interesting, if you go to the Ohio NARAL site, it'll show you 3 other clinics that are in Michigan and in Pennsylvania. So adding to the list, because there are only 9 here in Ohio, and they apparently want to make people aware of that there is availability in other states. Uh-huh. I think the study about people who don't realize that abortion is still legal, it's interesting. There is a website now that was set up, abortionislegalinohio.com, that specifically tries to get information out to people. And, you know, you look at the abortion numbers that are tracked by the Ohio Department of Health. The last year that those numbers are available was 2019. And the number of abortions in Ohio fell by 2%, which is interesting, and it's good. I think everybody wants to see that happen. But the question is, did that happen because of better birth control? Did that happen because of less access to abortion? What was the reason behind that? And of course, we can't know that just by looking at that stat.
You know, going back to those transfer agreements, I don't want to pick nits, but is it legal for a hospital to turn somebody away if they are taken there by ambulance from an abortion clinic?
You know, I don't know.
What's the purpose
of those? I think every clinic now, as I understand it, has a transfer agreement, because that was part of the legislation. But I don't know. I mean, that was an argument that was being made, that certainly if there were a problem at an abortion provider and they took that patient to the hospital, the patient wouldn't be turned away, which is what the transfer agreement said, but it wasn't going to happen anyway. So I don't know the answer to that.
Hmm. Is there a transfer agreement law in Arkansas, Sarah Kellogg?
You know? I do not know the answer to that question. I don't think it's come up in the discussions of anti-abortion law, so I cannot answer that question.
And then, Karen, as far as the pro, I wonder if you could give us a thumbnail on the land of the pros and cons out there, and what it's like in Ohio. It sounds like in Arkansas, the primary leader, and especially in opposing legislation, is the ACLU. Is that the case in Ohio?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. You do have NARAL Pro-Choice Ohio. That's a pretty active group as well. But the ACLU is, of course, the entity that goes to court, and they've been busy. You know, they went to court with the heartbeat bill, of course. And it's interesting that a federal judge just extended the stay on the heartbeat bill fairly recently. There's also the bill that was mentioned earlier, the ban on abortions after a Down syndrome diagnosis. That's been suspended. That's in court as well. Then, you know, I mentioned the one about the burial of fetal remains. Yeah. That's supposed to be taking effect here shortly, but they're in court now trying to figure out how to work that one out. I mean, I was just doing a little research on the legislature last session, which ended at the end of last year, the 2-year session. There were 805 bills proposed in the House, and 4 of them dealt with abortion, including one that would make abortion a capital offense and have severe penalties for doctors who perform abortions. Of the 389 bills proposed in the Senate, 5 of them were related to abortion, and at least 2 of them went into effect, the one on fetal remains and the one on telemedicine. So, you know, this is an issue that comes back over and over and over again, which you would expect with a very conservative Republican makeup here in the Ohio House and Senate.
Right. It's real interesting. I'm going to turn to Susan in Omaha right now. Let's see. Hi, Susan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. You know, I want to point out that the Constitution has no mention of abortion, but apparently the Founding Fathers hid it there for the Supreme Court to find 200 years later. And the supporters of abortion don't seem to recognize that the laws are skewed in favor of abortion. Even with all these potential laws, it gives cover to irresponsible men and employers. Abortion does nothing to instill accountability in the man responsible. And say a father who wants to raise his child or parents who want to help their daughter have absolutely no standing. But after the birth, the man responsible can obstruct an adoption plan and can cause no end of trouble for the mother. So the laws are totally skewed. A woman, and in states with parental notification laws, by the way, have seen a drop in teen pregnancy. So is that not a good thing? I think the supporters should recognize the inequities in the laws.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Susan, for that. Appreciate your call. How much is it an issue of organizations now, Sarah Kellogg, pro-rights and pro-abortion rights and anti-abortion rights groups coming to a head? Is there a sense in Arkansas? Do you have a sense about how much the public at large feels or cares about this?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I recently the Arkansas Right to Life is an organization. They just recently had their March for Life. I think that there is, as far as the sense of the public's reaction, you know, I think ultimately, if you attend the hearings, it's definitely, you know, counting kind of who's voting for it, who's testifying for and who's against the bill. Ultimately, there are people testifying for abortion bans. And then a lot of them are women who had abortions and had either traumatic experiences or said, you know, I can no longer have children for they had it when they were younger. Mm-hmm. And then there were a lot of women and people kind of abortions against it. And ultimately, you know, if you break down who's for and against, ultimately there are more that are against if you're counting the hearings. But there is definitely support for both of those. And I think that, you know, with a supermajority in both chambers, there's only, you know, I think that people know how these votes are going to go. So there's only so much they can do. I do want to say also, you know, talking about abortion bills that are going through this particular session, there has been one that you would call it a pro-life bill, and they've been labeling it as a pro-life bill, which would allow, and it's not passed yet, but it's close, and it would allow pharmacists to prescribe up to 6 months worth of birth control without having just to give to people who seek birth control. Uh-huh. And the people who are for that bill, both sponsors are Republicans and saying, this is another pro-life bill. This will reduce pregnancies. This will reduce, which will reduce the amount of abortion. And so that will likely be a bipartisan bill that will make it out.
That's interesting. Very interesting. Cause I don't think that's the way it would pan out in Ohio, but Karen Kassler, you know, it seems to me that it is now an absolute litmus test to get a Republican nomination for anything. Practically, you have to be anti-abortion rights. And what are your thoughts about that? And the fact that the state is so heavily gerrymandered toward Republicans at this point, and even with the the new rules coming out on drawing those lines, nothing's going to change overnight. Far from it.
Well, and I don't know when those new rules on the lines are going to take effect, because with the Census Bureau right. not releasing numbers until September 30th and right. at least releasing apportionment numbers, which would tell us how many members of Congress we get and whether we're going to lose and go down from 16 to 15, those aren't due until April. You know, we don't know when those lines are going to be drawn. We don't know what they're going to look like. But when it comes to how people view abortion in Ohio, the last poll that I've seen that I really think is rock solid is probably the Quinnipiac poll in 2019 that said that, and it was in July of 2019, 52% of Ohio voters opposed the so-called heartbeat bill, and 39% supported it. And that kind of tracks with another poll that Baldwin Wallace College did last year, or 2020 rather, which was last year. That's right. But I mean,
flew by, didn't
it's hard
it?
To keep up. Yeah. Right. Oh yeah. Right. But, you know, yeah, I think that being considered a pro-life candidate is absolutely a badge that any person who wants to run on a Republican ticket needs to seek out. I mean, it just, there seems to be very little in Republican circles for moderation on this issue. And then, of course, the question becomes, how pro-life are you? I mean, Ohio's so-called abortion or heartbeat bill ban does not include exceptions for rape and incest. Mm-hmm. It does include an exception for the health or life of the woman. So, you know, that's an area that I think some people who support restricting abortion rights are concerned about, the idea of these exceptions. And, you know, how that you've got some bills. I mean, Sarah mentioned the trigger law that has been proposed in Arkansas. We've got one. The only abortion legislation that's been proposed so far this session is exactly that trigger bill.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's a pretty extreme one, at least for some people as well. So the question then becomes, how far do you go on this issue? Is there any room for moderation at all?
That is all the time we have today. I thank you, Karen Kassler, so much. Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks again for your time.
Great to talk to you.
And Sarah Kellogg, politics and government reporter at KUAR, the NPR member station in Little Rock, Arkansas. Thanks for your time as well. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's it. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.